Monday, April 3rd. Leonard and I awoke late, blessedly, for it had been 2 o'clock when we'd gotten to sleep. It was a beautiful golden day. My hair was a disaster, and I dressed in my navy silk and the blue and white hat that Lucy had borrowed all last year, which covers everything, and went down for the arrival ceremony on the South Lawn at 11:30 for the President of Turkey and Mrs. Sunai. It was absolutely glorious. A South Lawn full of eager spectators, the Magnolia salangiana bursting out, daffodils in drifts by the tennis court. I was happy to remember that somewhere out in the crowd, personally escorted there by Ashton, was nice, bouncy Jean-Louis with his niece and nephew who are over from France. The arrival was like many others, and each is so dramatic that it would be an affront to life to forget anyone. The big black limousines rolled up, and Jimmy Symington squeezed out, introducing President Sunai, heavyset, very military, in his late 60s, and his plump, comfortable wife, who communicates with a smile but no English. It was beautiful pageantry, red uniforms on the balcony, and the glorious burst of the trumpets, flags whipping in the wind, my heart turning over at the first sudden shot of the 19-gun salute on the Mall, Lennon escorting President Sunai in a review of the troops around the South Lawn, the welcoming speeches to the battery of cameras, and then into the car, present with Lyndon in the first, Mrs. Sunai and Sylvia in the next, and I was trying to explain to her about our not-so-great ceremonial avenue and the inaugural parades there in the Capitol Dome in the distance, and the red-coated fife and drum corps in the uniform of George Washington's day, all the time looking at the moderate-sized crowds along the street, and remember that roaring welcome in Ankara, where it took us 2.5 hours to drive from the airport to the hotel, swamped by millions of enthusiastic Turks. Well, Washington is satiated, and they come here, heads of state, a dozen or two a year. Mrs. Sunai was beaming. We deposited them at Blair House, and then came home where I lunched with Linda in my room. There's something very special about this day, this week, because for the first time in 5 months, we have both of our girls under the roof of the White House with us. In the afternoon, I took a long ride with Mary Lasker and Nash Kestrel, Haynes Point and Pennsylvania Avenue, to Jefferson School, a review of things we've done in the last 2 years as spring comes into full flower. A rather firm decision to plant our white dogwoods, the 40,000 gift of the inaugural committee, along the banks of the Potomac as you approach Memorial Bridge on the highway from the airport. I want them identified and remembered as the gift of the inaugural committee of 1964. These rides around Washington are both quiet balm and quick adrenaline. I love seeing what's been done. I yearn to see more. My enjoyment of Nash and Mary grows with each season. Back at the White House, I worked at the desk, had a rub, and then went into the Oval Room to look at the gifts. I was not pleased with ours. The usual books and photographs, all right. A set of place plates, not as handsome as I would like. And a copy of George Washington's sword. This for President Sunai was rather good. There's for us an enormous, handsome Turkish rug. A lifetime of handwork, I'm sure. And for me, a dress and jacket of exquisite fabric encrusted with embroidery. I put on my Jean-Louis chiffon with its rather psychedelic drift of colors. And then Jean-Louis came in, bubbling as I knew he would, about his visit to the White House and the arrival ceremony. There were the usual tense moments of seeing that Lyndon was into his tux and down at the front portico just in time. We weren't quite. And then the President and Madame Sunai alighted with the Essenbells, swift pursuit, and we went upstairs for the drink and the get acquainted ceremony, taking with us just their son, Dr. Attila Sunai, and their Minister of Foreign Affairs and his wife, Dean in Virginia, and our Ambassador Parker Hart. Linda and Lucy came in, Lucy quite lovely in her apricot chiffon, part of her trousseau, and her hair piled high, excited because she had, as she said, her first manicure in 5 months, and it was such fun to feel elegant again. Jean-Louis was so touched by her delight in that he'd insisted on giving her her hairdo. Linda was lovely. To me, she looked regal and rather vulnerable, in a young, sweet, sad way. In her hair, she was wearing the pin that had been worn to a party for General Lafayette. Miss Hudspeth had given it to her. Following the colors, we took our guests down the grand staircase, photos, and then on to the East Room to receive the 140 guests. From the cabinet, Joe Fowler and the McNamaras, Justice and Mrs. Brennan from the court, and a not very large contingent from the Senate, Sue Symington without Evie, who's ill, and Bill and Betty Fulbright, hotly pursued later on by all the reporters, Thurston Martin,
and Senator and Mrs. Tower of Texas, whom I myself had put on the list when I had combed it and found that they had not been to a state dinner in over 3 years. Tall, impressive Governor Love of Colorado was there. Congressman Bob Jones of Alabama. The Ray Hares, he'd been ambassador to Turkey when we made our marvelous visit there. And Betty Furness. Everybody's told us how many hours she has spent working on her job, how much she loves it. From business, there were the John Harpers, Aluminum, the George William Millers, Textron, the Joseph Culmans of Philip Morris, and a balance from labor. There were old friends and house guests, Roy Huffines of Houston, and Ruth and J. Lee Johnson from Fort Worth. I asked them to join me after dinner for a nightcap on the second floor. From entertainment, B. Lilly, a few people asking of autographs, and she as wide-eyed as any. I did want her to have a good time, and I worried a bit about her until I saw that she was sitting next to Walt Rostow. And Spira Skouras, who was seated next to Linda Bird. From the press, my traveling companion, Francis Lewin, and handsome Eric Severide of CBS. The young Charles Weltners of Atlanta, newly with the Democratic National Committee, and something of a hero with young intellectuals. Interesting vignettes of the evening to me, Dean Acheson, that courtly intellectual of yesteryear, telling me quite earnestly that Linda Bird looked like Nefertiti, and Adolph Burley, another old-timer, wandering quietly around in the Red Room with his wife, looking at presidential portraits. I went up and talked with them. He told me that he had first come here during President Taft's time and reminisced a bit about all the presidents he'd worked for. He is stoutly and articulately on Lyndon's side in the Vietnam issue, and with keen pleasure I expressed our gratitude. I was seated between the President and the Minister of Foreign Affairs, and found to my delight that the Minister spoke some English. But, like many of these evenings, it was one I had to work at, relying heavily, of course, on the very real delights of my visit to Turkey. Ankara, Izmir, Istanbul, with its romantic bazaar where I had purchased copper, and its beautiful harbor. We talked about archaeology, and President Sunay told me that they had discovered as many as 6 cities, layer under layer under layer, that everywhere you dug in Turkey, you were likely to find signs of man's past, because Anatolia especially was sort of a bridge between Asia and Europe. Willie Day had thoughtfully sent me a note about the President's wedding present to Lucy, so I was able to thank him for the beautiful rug which would someday add character to their home. I smiled across Monroe's Vermeer at Lyndon, bracketed between 2 Turkish-speaking ladies, and reaching across Miss Cagliangul to talk to Mr. Justice Brennan. Both Lyndon and President Sunay invoked the memory of the Truman Doctrine 20 years ago this year with words of praise, and my eyes searched for Dean Acheson's face. He must remember it with satisfaction. In the words of one commentator who is still with us, the Truman Doctrine was a disastrous entanglement in an anti-communist crusade which could only lead to a much wider war, Lenin said, and then went on, today, Greece and Turkey and Korea are taken for granted as dynamic, freedom-loving nations, and I hazard the guess that in 20 years, the Republic of Vietnam will similarly be taken for granted. I hope I shall live to see some of today's problems settled, but I dare say there'll be plenty others. And who can predict of what sort, engulfing us in the world, stridently competing for attention? I think of the speaker and his story about the man who came into his office saying he had the worst problem in the world to discuss with him. And the speaker said to his visitor, did you see that man that brushed by you as you were coming in? He was on the way out. Yes, said the visitor. And the speaker said, well, he had the worst problem in the world. We went into the Red Room for coffee and liqueurs. And one of the guests I was most delighted to see, Sherman Birdwell from Austin, came up. I'd heard at the last moment from Bill Deason that he was in town and added him to the list. And we had much to reminisce about. It was nearly 11 when we went into the East Room to see one of the most offbeat performances in the White House entertaining that I have seen, and one of the most delightful selections from Offenbach's Voyage to the Moon. I introduced it with some words of praise for Sarah Caldwell.
its very imaginative, creative director.
It was hilarious, a sort of a Jules Verne fantasy. Costumes of black and white plastic raincoats and umbrellas, and moon rockets and wacky scientists,
and everything turning out all right in the name of love. The story was printed in both English and Turkish, in such a handsome program that once more I was proud of our White House arrangements. Our guests made their departure right after the entertainment. The next day the press made much of the fact that Senator Fulbright had left ahead of them, and Lyndon was hardly 10 minutes behind them, but I lingered for half an hour, saying good night to all the guests, and then, with Ruth and J. Lee Johnson and Roy and Linda and Lucy, settled down for a good talk and nightcap on the second floor. Ruth had found a George Caleb Bingham of Pike's Peak, which he had purchased for their museum, an unheard-of feat. And Roy, it was in the back of both of our minds, his and mine, that Deanie was not there with us. Told me all about his children and their scholastic accomplishments. One of them, Roy Jr., is a professor at Harvard, speaks 11 languages and writes 9. It was a brisk, wide-ranging, interesting hour, with talk about everything from campaigns of 20 years ago to art in Texas and landscaping everywhere. Lyndon was in bed with his night reading, and I was so sorry that he missed it. This was the heart of our visit. But a happy hour doing just what I wanted to.